So welcome back, everyone. I'm going to build on the talk from last night and go into the first noble truth and likely the second noble truth as well. Elucidate some of those those insights that we spoke about. You know, there's three insights for each noble truth. So we'll explore that a little bit. So as I said last night, the first truth is the truth of dukkha, that there is this suffering or unsatisfactoriness, this unease that's present in our life, that's part of being human, that it's unavoidable. And so that's the first noble truth, is to be understood, to be penetrated, and to be known. That's the work of the first noble truth. So really understanding and fully experiencing how your life is intertwined with dukkha, and facing that reality of existence. There's this old story of 83 problems. The Buddha was approached by a person and said, I would like some help. And I have 83 problems that I'd like help with. And the Buddha said, well, I can't help you with those 83 problems. And of course, the person said, well, what kind of teacher are you? You can't help me with these problems. And the problems were things like, you know, I have an illness, and then there was a death in the family, and so on. Those kind of things that is part of human existence. So the person said, well, what kind of teacher are you if you can't solve these 83 problems? And the Buddha said, well, I can help you with your 84th problem. And the person said, well, what's the 84th problem? So the 84th problem is that you want not to have any problems. So there's a person that wasn't understanding that life is part of life is the experience of these unavoidable difficulties. They speak of there being three types of dukkha that we experience. There's a dukkha. I say it twice. I guess it's really something. That's just the physical and emotional pain that is experienced, like stubbing your toe, that kind of unavoidable pain that's experienced. The second is the viparima dukkha, and that's suffering that results from the unchanging nature of our existence, the impermanence. Everything's constantly changing. You don't feel like you ever sort of get a foothold on anything. It changes. You experience something pleasant, and you can't hang on to it. Things shift, and it changes. So that's the second type of dukkha, and that has to do with how we can experience suffering by trying to hold on to what is pleasant. So you don't just experience dukkha as the unpleasant. It's also how we want more of the pleasant, and that creates a dis-ease in our being. I spent 2 months in India at a tantric ashram, and that's all we explored was how the pleasant can, and our attachment with the pleasant can cause suffering. I mean, things like the chocolate cake meditation, which sounds like fun, but and he would say there's this village 45 minutes away that has chocolate cake, and we're going to go there. Of course, I probably remember this story in particular because I love chocolate. I guess, you know. It's a preference of mine is chocolate. So of course the mind conjures up how wonderful this is going to be, you know, after not having any dessert at all. It was a beautiful vegetarian offering, but no sweets. So the mind had this expectation and image of built up, quite grandiose, of course. And we walk all the way there. Of course, the walk just builds it up even more. And of course, you get there and you get your chocolate cake and the smell and the first bite. And then it wasn't quite what I had built up in my mind. There was this sense of suffering, of just not, it wasn't, you know, it didn't meet what the image that the mind, of course, can create. It was just an example of how we, how viparinama suffering, dukkha, manifests. And the last one is sankhara dukkha. This is the compositional nature or conditioned nature of our experiences. And so we, suffering comes in two ways. There's kind of the objective suffering that occurs. That's, you know, the physical, in the physical world. But then, of course, the mind causes suffering as well. It's kind of that our reaction to what is happening, or the story about what is happening, and the suffering that causes. And much of the suffering that we experience is of this nature. So you may hear those and think, "Oh, this, you know, it's a lot of dukkha. I see that." But the vast majority of the suffering that we experienced is mind-made. It's our reaction to nature. The unavoidable pain that occurs in our life is nature. Then we have a reaction to it. Oh, this shouldn't be happening to me. Or blaming, or so many different ways. And I'll talk a little bit about those ways that sankhara dukkha can manifest. So sankhara dukkha has its origin in craving, because we want things to be different than they are in that moment. Craving for things to be other than they are in that moment. So that's, there's this craving for something different. So we may blame others. We criticize ourselves. Distract ourselves in various ways. So this is the suffering that we can really explore and see in our practice, in our meditation, in daily life practice. So the practice is to be with what is, with this non-judgmental attitude. So when we say, you know, being in the present moment, non-judgmentally. It means being with what's arising moment by moment with this attitude of non-judgment, of acceptance, being with what's arising in this moment. Because as soon as you're conscious of it, of course, it's already occurred. You're really being with what's already arisen. So it's, you know, being willing to feel the ouch of our lives. many years ago, I had a teacher who noticed that impatience arises in me often. And so we explored this in a dialogue, and he invited me to explore impatience. So he said, when does impatience arise? I said, well, you know, grocery store lines. Ooh, bad news. Coming home from work, I have to pick up a few things, drop in, just big lineups. Impatience arises. You know, I try to scan the cashiers to see who looks the most efficient, right? Who has the fewest, who has the fewest items in the bags? Even like, do they all have stickers on the things? Because if there's no code, of course, they gotta send somebody to. And this was, of course, creating a lot of anxiety, this kind of way of being. So anyway, he said, what I want you to do is every day for the next month, I want you to go to this grocery store, just grab whatever and get into the longest line and be with impatience. So this is what impatience feels like in the body, in the heart, in the mind, what thoughts arise with it, what body sensations are arising, what's cascading, what's going on. Just really get to know it. And so I did this, and you know, at first it was quite challenging, and slowly I sort of got used to, you know, what it felt like. It was really just a lot of thoughts that fed it. This is, you know, the mental formations, the sankhara dukkha part. And that feeding of it, of course, it created some contractions in the body and stress that manifested as some tightness and so on. So I sort of got to know it. As I got to know it, of course, it started to diminish a little bit. I like to say it lost its juice. Because I was just observing, I was just seeing it, holding it in mindfulness. And as I held it in mindfulness, it wouldn't perpetuate and build, because mindfulness became more of the state of being as opposed to impatience and a feeding of impatience. Of course, I went back after a month, and I was asked to, you know, describe what happened, and I must have said something because it sounded like I needed more work, but I had to go back for another month and be with impatience. So you can do that with anything that's arising that you find, you know, grabs you, that it's a reactive kind of state, and it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun. It's just exploring an aspect of this personality that just manifests based on causes and conditions. It just happens to be there. I mean, from a long lineage of impatient people. Kind of a proud long lineage of impatient people. So it's being with the experience. So impatience feels like this. Back pain feels like this. Whatever it might be, anger feels like this. Knee pain feels like this. Being with the way things are. Suzuki Roshi said, "The person who can freely acknowledge that life is full of difficulties can be free because they are acknowledging the nature of life, that it can't be much else." This goes right to the heart of the First Noble Truth. The person who can freely acknowledge that life is full of difficulties can be free because they are acknowledging the nature of life, that it can't be much else. The nature of life. So it's nature manifesting. And as long as we're struggling with nature, as we're part of nature, we felt that walking outdoors together, how we're intertwined with, we are nature. And struggling with that, of course, creates suffering. So the first step is acknowledging that, as Suzuki Roshi says. So suffering's not a mistake or a problem. There's no need to blame or ourselves or others. And it can be seen. So you can see when the story about a painful or a physical or emotional event occurs and the story comes up, you can say, I recognize this, I see this. It can be seen mindfully. A lot of people think, I don't know a lot of people, some may think that the First Noble Truth is kind of like just a stepping stone to the others. I got to talk about it because there's a origin and then there's a cause and then we get to the juicy part, the good stuff. But really, even just acknowledging and understanding, experiencing and deeply knowing the First Noble Truth can be in and of itself transforming. It eases this struggle when something doesn't go exactly how we thought it might go. Or there's an illness or something arises. It can be transforming to be able to, this is part of life. This is part of nature, of being a human being. And we start to realize that it's possible to be to separate the arising of suffering from our identification with it. We can see suffering as just arising, which is quite different than there's a me, or this is happening to a self that needs to do something about it, that needs to change the immediate experience. So then we understand, we penetrate this first noble truth. We start to see how suffering arises in our life, the unavoidable dukkha, as well as the mentally created suffering that we add on to it. We start to see that in our practice. And in particular, I think it's important to really take this into our daily life and see how it arises in our daily life. The Four Noble Truths are to me, a daily life practices. Of course, there are also meditation practices, but I think when we can bring that into, we may meditate for an hour in the morning, but then there's the other so many hours of our day where this can be cultivated and known. So we understand and we know that this is true, and then we must be present in order to really apply that knowledge of the truth. So there's this kind of continuous mindfulness that we practice so that we can constantly see the arising of these types of dukkha. Suzuki Roshi, again, one of my teachers that I enjoy reading, I find very helpful, says in the prologue to Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, "In the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, in the expert's there are few." So once we know, you know that you know dukkha, that third insight, you can begin to live with the don't know mind. This beginner's mind. We don't know what's the future's going to be. So you can be open to the possibilities. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. If we think we know what's always going to happen, then there are few. So this is part of the knowing the first noble truth, the third insight, is allowing this beginner's mind or don't know mind to emerge. So we can be amazed at the possibilities rather than disappointed because some preconceived notion of what was supposed to happen didn't occur. Or dissatisfied because our expectations were not met. Here's a story called Good Luck, Bad Luck, Who Knows? There once was a simple farmer who lived and struggled alongside his neighbors and friends, trying to exist and fulfill a peaceful life. One day, news arrived from far away that his old loving father had died. His neighbors gathered to grieve, but the farmer simply said, "Good luck, bad luck, who knows?" In time, relatives brought a very fine horse of great cost, fine breeding, left to the farmer by his father. All the villagers and neighbors gathered in delight with him to celebrate his good fortune, but he simply said, "Good luck, bad luck, who knows?" One day the horse escaped into the hills, and when all the farmer's neighbors sympathized with the man over his bad luck, the farmer replied, "Good luck, bad luck, who knows?" A week later, the horse returned with a herd of wild horses from the hills, and this time the neighbors congratulated the farmer for his good luck. His reply was, "Good luck, bad luck, who knows?" Then, when the farmer's son was attempting to tame one of the wild horses, he fell off its back and broke his leg. Everybody thought this was very bad luck. Not the farmer, whose only reaction was, "Good luck, bad luck, who knows?" Some weeks later, the army marched into the village and conscripted every able-bodied man they found there. When they saw the farmer's son with his broken leg, they let him off. Now, was that good luck, bad luck? Who knows? So it's that kind of not knowing mind. It means not being limited by what we know, holding what we know lightly so we are ready for it to be different. Maybe things will be this way, maybe they won't be. Who knows? The second truth is the truth of the origin of suffering. This is craving that creates suffering. When the Buddha craves, mindfulness will inevitably arise. He talks about this clinging. The Buddha said, "He who understands clinging and non-clinging understands all the Dharma." And this comes about due to the law of dependent origination, the dependent co-arising. Everything is intertwined, dependent on everything else. So each moment occurs based on a multitude of factors that come together that cause that to arise. So you're being here today. You're being here at this retreat. You could, trace back some factors and say, okay, yeah, this. You might be able to think of a few factors, but then each one of those factors has a multitude of factors that cause that to arise, and then each one of those, and you see it kind of multiplies back and back and back. So you can never actually truly trace what compounds into any one happening. And part of what's arising moment by moment in our experience is it's coming through the sense doors. So everything we experience in our daily life comes through our sense of smell, sight, sound, the five usual senses, and the Buddha added the mind and cognizing as the sixth sense. So everything you experience comes through those. I mean, that's your life. So when you take sound, for example, you need three things. So you need the sense organ, picks up the sound. You need the sense object, which is the sound itself, that sound. And then you need sense consciousness. So you have to be conscious of the sound. So those three things have to come together, and that's called contact, and then it becomes part of your experience. So there could be a sound that you're not conscious of. You have the organ and the sound, but it didn't come into your consciousness. So there's a bird out there tweeting. Maybe a few of you have the sense, the consciousness of it. Only those that have the sense consciousness and the ear and the object have the experience of the sound. That kind of sums up your whole experience of the world. So what happens after contact is automatically there's a feeling tone that arises of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Everything that arises at contact, this feeling tone arises, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And you can see that for yourself, that's what's constantly going on. And that's based on, you know, your life experience, your genetics, the perceptions that you put on it. So a piece of music, you know, may be pleasant for one person and unpleasant for another. So perceptions, you know, play a big role in that as well. And then what happens after pleasant, unpleasant, neutral? So you have contact, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. At that point we have we could go into aversion or grasping. So if it's pleasant, we want more of it. If it's unpleasant, aversion, push it away. Neutral, indifference toward it. These are automatic, the feeling tone is an automatic reaction. What comes next is based on desire. A desire for more of something that you want. A desire for less of what you don't want. You want desire for more chocolate cake. Less Brussels sprouts. I don't know. That's about the only food I don't totally love. So that's where suffering. That's the point of suffering. So it's and really it's not even the desires that are harmful and cause suffering. It's the clingy mind state and the identification with the desire that causes suffering. I'll give you an example of sankhara, dukkha. One of our teachers is Matthew Flickstein, and I would go to these wonderful retreats that he would have, and they're kind of in a building with a central living room area where we would meet, and then there's three wings that go out with sleeping accommodations in those wings. And one time we were sitting in that kind of living room area, and he was giving a talk, and I was feeling very joyful and peaceful and just overjoyed. Listening to the words of Matthew, and then I became conscious of a toilet flushing. You can probably relate to this. You might have this, you know, the toilets would get stuck in flush mode, and it's just a sound, right? So the sound, the sense organ, and consciousness of it, and then but it didn't end there. I had some mental formations that built on that, you know. Oh, it's ruining Matthew's talk. This is terrible. And then it went to, you know, whose room? Don't they know that their toilet's on continuous flush mode? And even went into the environmental impacts of this. And then, you know, should I get up and fix that toilet? And on and on, right? And then I realized, I went from like quite an intense, joyful mind state to one of suffering like that. like that. It happened so quickly. And I could just hold that like in awareness, like, wow, that was one of the most poignant examples of Sankara Dukkha for me. In fact, I don't think I really believed much of what the mind said for a while after that, because I felt so much suffering in that moment. So that's suffering. So can we watch desire arise and fade without suffering? Or do we see where we start to cling, to identify, to see it as there's a self that needs this in order to be happy? This is all where the self gets created. It's a self that needs this in order to be happy. So it's the self that's grasping. It's the self is created through the grasping. Letting go of self is letting go of clinging. Jason Murphy, a teacher with the Dharma Punks, quoted saying, letting go of craving is a process of seeing it clearly and allowing it to be a part of ourselves without attachment or rejection. Seeing it clearly, allowing it without attachment or rejection. The Tao Te Ching quotes, free from desire, you realize the mystery. Caught in desire, you see only the manifestation. Free from desire, you realize the mystery. Caught in desire, you only see the manifestation. And Ajahn Sumedho, letting go is leaving things as they are. So letting go isn't discarding your desires out of aversion to them. It's not like throwing cold water on a fire. It's more like letting your very hot tea cool a little bit before you drink it. So we're not... we're not practicing any kind of aversion to a desire, and there's nothing wrong with desires arising. It's that obsession mind or clingy mind that manifests around it that causes suffering. We can also act according to what we value in the world, which is quite different than being attached to the outcome of that action. So you don't diminish your commitment to the goal by letting go of grasping to the outcome. So notice if there's a real attachment to outcome, or if you're in the moment. Some examples of this. I don't know if there's any trekkers go up like trekking up mountains, but. If you can imagine it, or if you do it, there's a goal of often getting to the summit, because there's usually a vista at the summit. So So there's the goal of getting to that summit, which is fine. It's, you set out to hike up this mountain. But are you so attached to that that that's all you see? Or is there enjoyment of each moment along the way? Because there's so many little intentions and moments that make up the hike. Each step you take, each breath you take, each pause and looking and companionship with others if you're hiking with others. So we're in the moment rather than being focused on the outcome. Makes the hike much more enjoyable. It also actually makes the getting to the goal more likely. I do this thing called dragon boating. 20 people get in a boat and they paddle and we race each other. So there's 20 and you have to paddle together. And as part of that sport, there's a synchronization that occurs, but there's also we have this teaching that we don't focus on the finish line. Because if you focus on the finish line, and there's 20 people that have to stay in stroke, you may go, "Well, that finish line, ooh, that boat's ahead of us, I better really go." The boat doesn't go faster if one individual paddles faster. The whole boat has to paddle together. That's how you win in dragon boating. The whole boat paddles exactly together. So focusing on the outcome actually makes the outcome less likely. But if we focus on the present moment and being together and in stroke, whatever our focus, our breath, or abdominal strength, whatever it might be, as opposed to attachment to the outcome of winning the race. So it's this clinging clinging that causes suffering. This is so profound, it's such a profound teaching that we can experience non-clinging and therefore non-suffering. By letting go of our attachment to outcome, by letting go of our obsession with things being a particular way. Letting go of the story that might arise about why things should be different. So we see these things may arise. I say letting go, they may arise, but we hold them with mindfulness. And you say, there it is, I recognize this story. Of course, as soon as it's held in mindfulness, it shifts. That's why I mentioned this continuous mindfulness. If we can, as much as we can put in some effort to be mindfulness, excuse me, for as much of the day, or to be aware when we're not mindful. It's like when you do the breath. I always look at that as a grace. So I'm following the breath, the mind wanders, suddenly I'm aware that I'm not on my breath. Just I didn't do anything. It was just this, like, it's kind of a grace. It's just something, just awareness sees that, and you gently go back to the breath. I kind of look at that in daily life too. We're going along kind of on autopilot, and then all of a sudden there'll just be this awareness. Oh, you're not aware of what you're doing. You're not aware of what's happening. You're an autopilot. You just come back to awareness. And in that way, awareness can become more the default than the exception in how we go through our day. So how do you abandon clinging? So there's a bit of a paradox of desire as well. It leads to suffering when it's grasped after. Yet without it, there's no movement. Desire is the energy that motivates us, and it's guides us through our life. There'd be no movement without that. But when we grasp after it, we suffer. So there's a bit of a paradox there. So we bring mindful attention to our to desire. Does it cause suffering? Is it consistent with our deeper values? You can look at mindfulness and to see clearly clinging. So separate the desire from your attachment to the desire. They're two different things. There can be a desire, but notice if there's attachment to the desire. Another, time for more stories. I like stories. But another Matthew story. He asked us all what our favorite ice cream was. I don't know if you remember this one, the favorite ice cream event. So everybody had all these favorite ice creams. Like I'd never heard of most of them. Very complex, like types of ice cream, all kinds of things in them, right? And so off Matthew went to get some ice cream, and of course he's out in Rutgersville, Virginia, where there's a corner store, general store. They were not going to have any of these Ben and Jerry's and I don't know, all these different
Chunky Monkey.
Yeah, what was one of them?
Chunky Monkey
and all. So he comes back with the Neapolitan was as fancy as it got, and the others were vanilla and chocolate. So a couple of people might have chose one of those chocolate or something. But he comes back, and of course, you know, we've chose this favorite ice cream. So there's a desire, there's a preference. It's what we were asked, and we have a preference. We like this type of ice cream. But did we want it? Did we create the idea in our mind that we had to have that in order to enjoy it? So when he came back with it, there wasn't really a sense in this group, at least, that, oh crap, this is going to be crappy ice cream. It was just all ice cream, and there was enjoyment. So we were able to separate the desire from the attachment to it. Very important. Examine the desire itself and see how it relates to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And is it in the present or the future? So see, examine it in relation to the arising of the feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And look for signs that you're caught in clinging. This is so important. Is there tension in the body? Feelings of anxiety, kind of a good signpost that there's clinging. So look for signs that you're caught in clinging. Look for stories that accompany the clinging. It's the clinging to outcome. Is it a narrow, repetitive? Is it a drain on energy? Or can you separate the desire itself from the attachment to outcome? I look at those repetitive stories. Another good signpost, feel tired. That's because it's draining energy. Next, begin to notice that your awareness of the clinging is separate from the actual clinging. So as soon as you hold something in awareness, what you're holding shifts. The next moment is different. It's the power of mindfulness. As soon as something's held in mindfulness, it shifts. It shifts what happens next. So notice that the two are separate. And then you can begin to invite the mind to let loose of the clinging. But be careful not to fall into aversion. You don't want to become develop aversion to clinging. is a danger. Be careful not to substitute clinging to abandonment for clinging to desire. So loving kindness and compassion are also crucial in this practice. And also noticing if the ego seizes the practice, and if it becomes an ego project. Yeah. So I invite you to to practice with observing and holding in mindfulness this whole experience of desire arising. So notice when something, there's contact, something comes into your realm of experience, sound, taste, thought. Notice the feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is there, noticing which is there, noticing if it moves into craving, wanting more of the pleasant, less of the unpleasant, noticing if there's a story that overlays, story of blame, self-blame, blaming others, whatever the story might be. And with this practice, we're noticing when suffering arises because of those things, and we're also noticing when non-suffering arises. This is very important as well. It's when you have an experience or desire arises, and it just is. It's just allowed to be as it is. You've experienced non-suffering. So you can dwell in that kind of spaciousness and equanimity that's present. That's some people call that a temporary release or a symbolic release. That cessation for a moment. So remembering those is very important in holding those is very important, because that's what the practice is about, is total set. So it's like that, having that moment your whole life, have that taste. Total cessation. So really holding the moments of non-suffering, as well as being aware when suffering is arising.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.